Another good economic sign.
As the Fed meets in Washington.
From APM American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, March 13th.
Coming up, patent wars in Silicon Valley.
Why the widening of the Panama Canal is a big problem on the West Coast.
And Rick Santorum's economic views.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The top policymakers at the Federal Reserve are holding a meeting today in Washington to decide what to do next when it comes to monetary policy. For more, let's bring in our regular Tuesday guest, Julie Neiman. She's an analyst at Smith Moore & Company, and she's with us now from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So most economists are saying they're not expecting anything new from the Fed, no change in interest rates, no new bond buying programs, but also no pullback of the stimulus that's already there. Do you agree with all that?
Well, that's it. We're going to hold steady. They're going to comment probably on the mildly positive economic environment, no hints of further easing, but they won't take it off the table either, just in case we get a shock. And by the way, this won't be oil. The rise in oil prices will not derail this economic recovery because we have more fuel-efficient cars and we're not driving as much. We're just not heating.
Well, what about the news this morning that retail sales are up? One of the big things the Fed's been trying to do with some of its stimulus is to get people to save less and spend and lend more. Is this morning's news that retail sales are up 1.1% last month good news?
Well, 70% of the economy does depend upon spending because spending leads to more income growth. It's a virtuous cycle, and it is showing up in retail sales. Even if you take out auto and gas, old cars replacement, price of gas is going up, but not more is being consumed. Retail sales are still up and nicely. Building materials, everybody's fixing things. Good gains in clothing, spring has sprung across the nation. And restaurants, and we're not just talking about cruising through Mickey D's, but independent restaurants are seeing real nice pickup here. That's a positive, real direction. It's not table-pounding growth, but it's positive.
You think we're getting more confident, Julia?
I think we're seeing it simply because we're looking at good postings and job gains. We have more than 200,000 last month, and that's the third month in a row that we've seen some improving numbers. Now, are they high-quality jobs, high-paying? Not particularly, but they're jobs, and it's heading in the right direction. We've got gradual improvement underway here.
Julie Neiman, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Whistleblowers and American corporations are sending thousands more tips to the Securities and Exchange Commission to take advantage of a program that can make turning in your employer more lucrative than winning the lottery. Joining me live to talk about it is Marketplace's Gregory Warner. Gregory, remind us, what is this whistleblower rule and how does it work?
Well, this was passed in April as part of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Bill. And the theory was that if whistleblowers are more motivated to come forward, then the government will know earlier about financial fraud or market manipulation. And maybe the government could have even avoided the financial meltdown. So the whistleblower rule offers anyone who brings a credible tip to the SEC the chance at a cash reward of up to 30% of whatever the SEC gets from the company in court. So on a $30 million fine, the whistleblower picks up $9 million. That's an incentive to report accounting fraud.
Yeah, it's an incentive. Now, one of the big concerns when the bill was passed was that the SEC doesn't have the staff to handle these tips.
You know, that is still a real concern, although a very interesting thing has happened as a result of this reward program. The SEC has gotten some new help from lawyers. You wouldn't call it ambulance chasing, but lawyers are definitely seeing a reward in helping whistleblowers present their evidence in the most useful way to the SEC. Earlier this morning, I had a long conversation with Reuben Gutman. He's head of whistleblower practice at Grant and Eisenhoffer. And he says lawyers' involvement makes the difference between the SEC getting, say, a hastily written email from a company insider and a packet of court-ready documents.
The theory is that if the agency doesn't use the information, then the whistleblower will be compensated.
And so will his lawyer.
And so will his lawyer.
I talked to another lawyer in New York. He said we should see the first successful case and the first payout in a few months.
All right. Marketplace's Gregory Warner. Thank you.
David, what is your most precious electronic gadget?
Come on, I can't pick which ones. Like, which of your children do you like best?
Your phone, your iPad, your Kindle, your Nook, what? Well, it wouldn't exist, probably, whatever it is, without the rare earth metals inside. And China has a big slice of the world's supply of those rare earths. Now the Obama administration is taking China to the World Trade Organization, saying it's not playing fair with those crucial raw materials.
Joining us is the BBC correspondent in Shanghai, John Sudworth. Hello.
Hi, David.
Why are U.S. officials with European Union support so concerned about restrictions on rare earth mineral exports from China?
Well, the allegation is that because China is restricting the export of those materials, it's driving up global prices, which is hitting economies not just in North America, but in Europe and elsewhere, too.
Now, will bringing this case to the WTO change the dispute?
It's difficult to know whether this case at the WTO will make a huge difference. China already is saying that it is justified in putting the restrictions in place because they are there for environmental protection and to protect its own economy. And to some extent, you can sympathize with that argument. China holds only one third of the world's reserves of rare earths, and yet it's responsible for 90% of the production. And that's widely believed to be because it's only in China that you can do the kind of mining with all of the consequent environmental damage that comes from the kind of mining we're talking about. Elsewhere in the world, it wouldn't be possible. And China says because of that reason, it needs to put the restrictions in place. Of course, the counter-allegation is that they're there simply as an element of protectionism, and that's why they're being challenged.
The BBC's John Sudworth in Shanghai. Thank you.
Thanks very much, David.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
America's busiest ports may not stay as busy. Southern California currently gets most of the imports shipped from Asia, but that could change with a major expansion of the Panama Canal. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Southern California traffic jams aren't just on the roads. Congestion can stretch out into the Pacific. Monster ships with big horns. The ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach are the busiest in the country, but that business isn't guaranteed. The Panama Canal is adding a new, deeper lane that will allow huge cargo ships from Asia to reach the East Coast. Robert Puentes with the Brookings Institution expects California will lose some business.
How big that shift is going to be is still unclear. There are estimates for a 25% drop in around L.A. That's probably on the high end. But we do know there's going to be some kind of emphasis on the East Coast ports.
Sending Asian imports through the Panama Canal takes longer. It's faster to send cargo across country by railroad. But congestion around the Los Angeles ports can slow things down. Paige Siplon is with the Center of Innovation for Logistics. It's his job to promote the port of Savannah, Georgia.
The congestion comes up all the time, not just in my conversations, but in business conversations. The congestion on the West Coast ports is a huge challenge.
California is fighting to protect its shipping business. Recently, a coalition of business and political leaders launched a campaign called Beat the Canal.
Hundreds of thousands of jobs are at risk.
If we lose to the canal, we lose job opportunities and business opportunities for a whole generation.
It comes back to that issue of congestion. Paul Bingham is chief economist with the Jobs First Alliance. It's pushing to build new roads, bridges, and rail depots to help speed cargo from the ports.
In many cases, those projects are ready to go with the funds today if we could get through the government permitting process.
He says government red tape can tie up projects for years. Meanwhile, the new lane of the Panama Canal is expected to open in 2 years. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Now to the Republican presidential race. Voters in Mississippi and Alabama will have their say today on who the party's nominee should be. Polls show a close race right now in both states. We're going to continue our series now on the economic views of the candidates with someone who's been following Rick Santorum's career in Pennsylvania for a long time, Terry Madonna. He's director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College. He's with us now from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, if you listen to Senator Santorum's speech on Super Tuesday, there was a lot of what could only be described as economic populism, sticking up for the little guy. What is his record on that when it comes to his time serving the state of Pennsylvania?
Well, I mean, I think he has been described sometimes as a big government conservative. I mean, he represented a very large heterogeneous state, steel, coal, oil. He, you know, fought for the economic interests of the state. He was against NAFTA, in other words, against free trade. He supported a ban on steel imports. But he voted for lots of big budgets and for government spending. So, you know, the big point here is that it usually was at the behest of and in context with the business community.
If you look at Santorum's plans, it's clear that he wants to cut taxes and increase tax deductions. But on spending cuts, he is very vague. And I'm wondering, is this a guy who is just being coy about the spending cuts he wants, or is he just okay with having big deficits?
He does talk about reducing the deficit, but you're right, there's not a lot of specifics about how that would occur. You know, he does support balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, which would cap government spending at 18% of GDP growth. So, yeah, he's vague on the specifics.
But was he a big cutter when he was in the Senate?
No, absolutely not. I mean, he voted for increases in government expenditures when he approved the federal budgets, of course.
Let me finally ask you about Santorum's own economic background. Tell us something that we don't know about him.
Well, maybe this, that he really talks about being sort of a blue-collar, working-class guy. But in reality, he grew up white-collar. His dad worked for the Veterans Administration. He was a psychologist. His mom was a nurse who worked for the VA. I don't see working-class roots. He talks about his grandfather in Somerset County in southwestern PA, you know, a miner. But in reality, he grew up with his parents working for the federal government. But he does empathize and talks about the geography in which he lived, which certainly, you know, does have a lot of blue-collar working-class folks.
Terry Madonna is director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College. Terry Madonna, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks as always.
And you can find out about all of the candidates' economic ideas at our website, marketplace.org.
Suffer disaster, get FEMA money? Well, it's not as automatic as you think. The governor of Illinois is appealing the decision of the Federal Emergency Management Agency to deny aid to five counties. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has more.
Bill Summers is fire chief in Harrisburg, Illinois, where seven people died in the February 29th tornado. He showed FEMA officials the damage, including a destroyed feed store, gas station, senior center, strip mall.
Then it went into what we call the country club area, where it was some high-dollar houses, where it just really wrecked a bunch of them.
When FEMA considers disaster aid, it doesn't just count damaged houses. It looks at private insurance coverage. Are there state and local disaster funds? And what's the disaster's impact per capita on the entire state? And that's just a start. With that in mind, Kentucky and Indiana got some tornado aid. Illinois and Ohio didn't. But unlike Illinois, Ohio won't appeal, says spokeswoman Tamara McBride.
Instead, we have requested through the Small Business Administration low-interest loans for the impacted residents in that community.
Illinois' governor insists that FEMA underestimated the tornado's impact on towns like Harrisburg. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
It's being promoted as the civilized alternative to sleeping on the sofa. The home building company, Del Webb, is offering some California homebuyers the option of an extra sleeping room off the master bedroom. Owner's Retreat, it's called. Hazard a guess what for? Sealing off the partner who snores. The LA Times reports the Sun City Shadow Hills development in Indio, California is going to offer the option. The developer has data showing that a quarter of older couples sleep apart to get a good night's sleep.
Yahoo is suing Facebook for violating patents that Yahoo owns. The patents in question aren't for obscure parts of Facebook's business. They're right central to what Facebook does. Its big moneymaker advertising is involved here. And the dispute comes just as Facebook is trying to look great to investors as it prepares to go public. Marketplace Tech Report host John Moe is with us now to explain what's going on. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, tell us what exactly this complaint is all about.
Everything. Yahoo says the core of what Facebook does is based on things Yahoo already was doing, creating profiles, the news feed, the privacy policy, the messaging. They say that was all stuff that Yahoo came up with first, and it's covered by patents that Yahoo owns. Pretty much everything except the color blue that Facebook uses in its design is covered here. Now, Facebook has been eating Yahoo's lunch for a while in social, so this is a really bold move to try to get back some footing in that competition. And for its part, Facebook says this is disappointing to be sued by what it considers to be a partner, and it will defend itself. You got to wonder if this is going to hurt Yahoo's benefits from that partnership.
And John, patents sound obscure in everyday conversation, but I gather this is pretty central to how Silicon Valley does business, and these fights really matter.
Yeah, patent lawsuits are the ground troops in the wars between these companies. We've seen a ton of suits lately coming from Apple, Google, Samsung, Microsoft. Kodak is even involved. I mean, everybody's getting on board. And there's a lot of concern that it could mean higher prices for you and me. These lawyers got to get paid, after all. And there's concern that it could have a chilling effect on innovation, because if you're one of these developers trying to come up with the next big, amazing thing, you're looking over your shoulder wondering if you might get sued as a result of what you come up with because somebody else came up with it first. I mean, there's a line between the inspiration that you draw and then the innovation you come up with.
John Moe, host of Marketplace Tech Report, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
United and Continental Airlines have completed their merger. Many who follow the airline industry say the next airline merger could be between U.S. Airways and American Airlines. In fact, U.S. Airways has hired on some merger advisors. And one thing they did early on was to buy up internet domain names like American-USAirways.com.
A little presumptuous, perhaps. In today's Midday Extra, we ask what a company like U.S. Airways has to do or should do in preparing for a possible merger. Here to talk with us is Lou Whiteman, senior writer at The Deal. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why is a company like U.S. Airways going out and buying the web addresses before they know what's going on? Is that typical?
I don't know if it's typical, but I think it is a reminder that companies more and more are thinking about their web presence and the power of the web as a communications tool. U.S. Airways is clearly, they've been quite open about their potential interest, but there would also be quite a bit of opposition to yet another airline deal. And this is one way to communicate with perhaps possible opposition and get their message out there. I would suspect the domain registration is just the most visible of a number of things they're doing, perhaps reaching out to sources of capital and maybe even overtures to American labor groups to gauge potential reaction to a deal.
Now, it doesn't really inoculate U.S. Airways from the advances of some other perhaps less favored merger partner, does it? I mean, if someone else wants to swoop in, they could just perhaps come up with some other website name.
Yeah, no question about it. I think it has to be more seen as a tool they can use to get their message out than it is to prevent someone else from stepping in.
Can you remember any other example of something like this happening where before a merger is even in the works, really, in an official way, that a company goes out there and makes a move like this?
I can't think of anything with domain names. I think it's been pretty common. The airline industry is such a tight-knit group. There's been a lot of executive hires, say, in advance of deals. The highest-profile one was Delta hiring Richard Anderson, the former CEO of Northwest Airlines, and then less than a year later acquiring Northwest Airlines. There's been a lot of lower-level position examples like that where you're sort of blending the company or getting a feel for the potential target ahead of time.
Maybe it's just to save a couple bucks because, you know, there's always some joker out there who picks up the paper, notices there's a merger brewing, snaps up the domain name, and then you got to buy it back from them.
It's not a bad idea, or someone who might want to complain about the deal or the prospect of a deal. And in a way, I guess you're preventing bad publicity that way.
Hey, let me ask you one more thing, Lou. How important is a website name for a company these days?
Well, you know, the beauty of the web is you can arrange words in any way you want. So that you can't possibly get every website. But I think they see it as more, again, of a tool where they can establish official presence and have a place where people go. A lot of high-profile bankruptcies now. We've seen, say, American Airlines Reorganization.com as a clearinghouse for information on the reorganization. Gone are the days, obviously, where, you know, you have to go down to the court or go down and read the papers and look at the hard copy. This is just more part of the way that I think companies, especially in the case of U.S. Airways, where there may not be a lot of momentum for a deal outside of the company's boardroom, it's a way to get their message out there and I guess, argue their case.
Lou Whiteman, senior writer at The Deal, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A brand new reality show about fashion hits TV screens tonight. As Marketplace's Eve Trove reports, brand is the operative word for this thing on NBC called Fashion Star.
Fashion Star is Project Runway's more materialistic little sister. Designers compete to launch a clothing line, but here, haute couture is not du jour. It's about mass appeal. Fashion Star mentor Nicole Richie gives this advice.
You can't just be an artist. At a certain point, you have to be a businesswoman as well.
Fashion Star spotlights the unsung power brokers of fashion, retail buyers. Reps from Macy's, Saks, and H&M bid on each round's winning design, and that design goes on sale the minute the episode ends.
You can wear the winner the next day.
Retail strategist Candace Corlett says that's what shoppers expect.
As soon as they learn of it, they want to be able to have it.
Used to be, designers built buzz for months before a collection hit stores. Now?
Don't show it to shoppers until you're ready to make it available to them, because 6 months from now, they'll be on to something else.
NBC shot the show about 6 months ago. That bought time to mass produce the winners. Fashion Star's retail partners have already bet big on the clothes and the show's success. I'm Eve Trow for Marketplace.
And finally to Iowa, where Dave Larson just turned 40 years old. And to celebrate his big birthday, he decided to run 40 miles. He started at 7 a.m. and ran right until 2:30 in the afternoon, with his wife and kids following in a car to cheer him on. After it was all over, his wife Leanne said she was proud of him, but she told the Des Moines Register, "I don't want to do it for my 40th birthday. I'm thinking spa."
Right. That. What is that like? Almost two marathons.
That's a long way. I have to say, you know, maybe I'd run 4 miles for my 40th birthday, but not 40. I think I'm with Leanne on that one. Spa sounds good to me. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.